I'm calling the talk The Treasure of Tranquility in the Body and Mind. : From Seclusion to Inclusion. And I just came up with that part last night because I was focusing initially on seclusion. You know, to be tranquil, we have to kind of seclude the mind from certain things. But then I saw that the seclusion actually helps us include it all. So I revised that. And I do want to say that in all these talks, whenever I do a talk, I'm learning too, and I change. I write my paper or my talk, and then I think, well, no, that isn't what I meant. I mean this, and it's just a process. So you might notice that in this talk, like I revealed about the from seclusion to inclusion. But I thought that was really important for me to see that, to that the seclusion that supports tranquility actually leads to the ability to be inclusive, to include and not reject. So this talk is going to be about coming back to the happiness and simplicity of awareness in the present moment. Tranquility helps with that. And about seclusion from things that disrupt the mind's ability to see clearly and include it all, because we are so susceptible to disruption of the focus of the mind and the tranquility of the mind. And so we've spent the month of this month, May, and which has five Sundays, on the fifth step in the transcendent dependent arising sequence, which begin with suffering. Suffering being the supportive condition for faith, the second step. Faith being the supportive condition for joy, the third step. Joy being the supportive condition for rapture, the fourth step. One, two, three, four. And rapture being the supportive condition for tranquility, the fifth step. Next Sunday, we will move to happiness in July, and to concentration after that. So you can kind of intuitively see why tranquility would be an essential part of this unfolding, especially since it lies between the energetic and delicious state of rapture and the still and centered calm of concentration. The Buddha called his path the middle way, and tranquility does seem to be important for finding balance at this point in the path. Tranquility is needed to make the scattered mind less vulnerable to disturbances and from the hindrances. The hindrances that as human beings we are all prone to. And we need to be humble about that. You know, we're all really vulnerable to these hindrances. And I'm going to name some of them, and you can think of the ones that you're dealing most closely with right now, or which historically have been, you know, ones you've had to deal with a lot. So just to remind us, we're all prone to desire and craving, or aversion, irritation, anger, and blame, or dullness of mind, sleepiness, avoidance, or restlessness and worry, anxiety, regret, or doubt, indecision, lack of confidence in ourselves or in the Dhamma. I know that I've had a history of anxiety as a hindrance, worry, catastrophic thinking. Those are some that rise up for me. and I would really like to be tranquil with, but that's a process. One just tranquility gives us, let's see. With a tranquil mind, so when we have a tranquil mind or some degree of tranquility, it's possible to see and hold these hindrances without being thrown off by them. Tranquility gives us a little space to be with what is difficult, so we aren't afraid or defeated by it. One teacher describes this process as composting. Composting the hindrances. I like that. Something needs to be done to transform them and disarm them, but it's not clinging to them or resisting them. It's composting. So it's some kind of a working with them and kind of feeling them and, getting your hands dirty and then they kind of are disarmed. They're not all the trouble that they have been. So I'm talking this morning about having both a peaceful body and a peaceful mind because they're closely related and they actually help each other. Finding tranquility in the body mirrors tranquility in the mind and vice versa. And I've experienced this because I have a daily Qigong practice. You don't have to have a daily Qigong practice, but this is just an example of my experience with how the body, tranquility of the body, works with tranquility of the mind. So I take a weekly class and I practice daily with Qigong. And the emphasis in Qigong is relaxed effort and slow, soft movements in harmony with the breath are emphasized. And my teacher says, this isn't exercise. It is a meditative movement practice. And he reminds us all the time, 70% effort is the maximum. When he introduces a new form, he says, have the intention, but don't make it happen. He says, relax a lot. Relax the belly. Relax the knees, relax the shoulders, the jaws, the eyelids. And then when you relax, relax a little more. Move with an inner smile. It's not always easy to relax certain parts of the body, especially if you're just told to, but it's good to remember that it's important to relax. I'm going to talk about a specific challenge I had. I knew paying attention to relaxing my body has helped me in many ways in my meditation practice as well as in my daily life. And I also knew that the default state of my belly was not relaxed. I discovered that when I first started meditating a number of years ago, most of the time I didn't pay attention to my stomach. I didn't realize I was holding it in. But every time I checked, it was tight. And I just decided to give up. This is just my state of being. But then I learned that a teacher whom I respect a lot, some of you, I'm sure, know of him, Sayadaw Utejaniya, he's a Burmese monk. He has a list of practice steps. And step one is value relaxation. I noticed that he didn't order us to relax, which might cause us to try too hard to relax and defeat the purpose. He said to value relaxation. And I realized that I wasn't valuing relaxation by ignoring my not relaxed belly. So I decided to begin paying attention to it during my daily life. And that would give me many opportunities to practice relaxing, which I'm doing right now. This is a work in progress. I'm not expecting or achieving a perfectly relaxed belly, but I am enjoying and valuing relaxation. And I just check during the day I check my belly, and it's usually tight, but I think it's getting a little looser. And it's bringing me more awareness of a felt sense of release in my body. I really hadn't noticed what release, I hadn't paid attention to the actual act of releasing. And releasing is letting go. So I noticed that the release may start when I do it in my belly. It may start in the belly, but it actually moves and expands to the whole body. So then I have a released, relaxed, calmer feeling in my whole body. And then I noticed that it extends into the mind. I've noticed that the mind has a greater value on that release now. So when I am, say, irritated, which is one of the things that when I get irritated, it's one of the hardest things for me to let go of, because like I'm irritated and I just want to be irritated because it's wrong, or, you know, so I kind of harden into it. But because I've been practicing with releasing my belly and feeling how pleasant that is and noticing it and paying attention to it, I can kind of juxtapose that relaxed, released feeling of letting go with the tight, hard feeling of irritation and wanting to stay in that irritation just to, because I'm angry. And I'm feeling, oh, you know, it really is better. I think, you know, there's a benefit, a much better benefit of just releasing it, just letting it go. So to me, that's an example of how the mind and body are connected. They're really connected. And letting go, I know there's value in letting go. And there's certainly value in letting go of unwholesome feelings. And the pleasure of releasing in my body reminds me, yeah, let's just let go. They kind of just merge. So I'm suggesting that maybe you, we all can find places we hold tension in the body. And often those places, they're not always due to tension in the mind, but they can be. But even if they're not due to tension, maybe they're due to muscular tension of something that you know, one of your habits. But just practicing releasing body tension and feeling the relief and pleasantness of that contributes to not only the overall tranquility in the body, but overall tranquility in the mind too, I think. So another thing I've noticed is I've been practicing with the Buddha's mindfulness of breathing instructions, which are found in the Anapanasati Sutta. There are 16 progressive instructions, and two of the instructions deal directly with tranquility or calming. These practices are the ones that the Buddha himself used when he was on retreat. So the practice is different from the Four Foundations of Mindfulness in that the mindfulness of the breath is maintained throughout the whole 16 steps. And the mindfulness of the breath continues while one is at the same time being mindful of other experiences in the body, or feeling tone experiences, or experiences in the mind, or experiences relating to wisdom. And the breathing accompanies and supports tranquility while one is mindful of these other objects of focus. For example, one of the mind instructions is calming the mind, I breathe in, calming the mind, I breathe out. So while one is calming the mind, One is breathing in and out, which can actually bring a sense of calm from the naturally calming rhythm of the ordinary neutral breath in the body. So hear the body and the breath are supporting the calming of the mind. So if we have a disturbance in the mind, a hindrance, a defilement, the breathing with it can help us bring tranquility to it, help transform it, disarm it, give us the ability to stay with it long enough to understand it deeply, so we won't resist it. Let's see. Well, calming the mind, one is breathing in and out, which actually can bring a sense of calm from the naturally calming rhythm of the ordinary neutral breath. Another instruction focusing on wisdom is focusing on impermanence. That's the wisdom. I breathe in. Focusing on impermanence. I breathe out. The accompanying mindfulness of breathing helps us approach a subject that could easily lead our discursive mind to think about and analyze it rather than knowing from our direct experience. The breath in the body offers a grounding to follow a deeper understanding, and it helps to keep the mind and body tranquil enough to see more clearly. So it supports the Buddha, what the Buddha said, that you can't just know something in a thinking way. You have to have direct experience of it. And this also, practicing with the Anapanasati meditation instructions, helped me to see how the harmony of the body and mind working together really support each other and add to more power in meditation to stay in the present with what is. So they build a powerful foundation of calm to abide in and move forward from. I do want to say a caution. As I've been practicing with the 16 instructions, I've gotten stuck at instruction 8, which is one trains oneself calming mental activities. Calming mental activities, I breathe in. Calming mental activities, I breathe out. I was afraid to go from step 7 to 8 because I thought approaching the mental, you know, I was doing really well with breathing in and out with the whole body and breathing in and out with joy and breathing in and out with pleasure. But I asked myself, how am I going to maintain any tranquility in the mental realm? And I wanted to avoid the mental realm. It had too many distractions and too many hindrances possible. So that's kind of a spiritual bypass, which Joseph Goldstein actually talks about as one of the drawbacks of tranquility too, that people get attached to it because it feels so good. So I wanted to bring that up. But just back to the benefits of tranquility. Bhikkhu Bodhi compares tranquility to a still pond that reflects like a mirror the object exactly as it is. Tranquility has a simplicity to it. When seeing, just see. When walking, just walk. No need to complicate things and make them more than they are. Joseph says that as tranquility is developed, desire is abandoned. It helps us to meet the hindrances and defilements without getting entangled in them. And it has a soothing influence on the body and mind. He also adds that a tranquil mind is said to contribute to honesty and sincerity. A feeling of things are okay. I don't need to make them what they are not. I don't need to be what I am not. So I thought that was an interesting aspect to tranquility. I hadn't thought of that. So I've spoken mostly of the positives about tranquility, and especially in our lives with all the busyness that we have, it's a relief if we don't get attached to it. But I also read something from Ajahn Sumedho, which made me pause and think, oh, this needs to be considered. He was writing in an essay on Anapanasati, and he said, the rhythm of our normal breathing is not interesting or compelling. It is tranquilizing, and most beings aren't used to tranquility. Most people like the idea of peace. They like the idea of peace, but they find the actual experience disappointing or frustrating because we desire stimulation. The gentle rhythm of the breath is slower than the rhythm of thought and takes us to tranquility, which is great. As the habitual obsessive thinking begins to fade, great spaces we never knew were there begin to appear. But most people like the idea of peace, but they find the actual experience disappointing or frustrating. And because we desire stimulation, and I think that's a fact that we deal with when we practice with tranquility, so I wanted to bring that up. So I wanted to talk about a memory that came up when I read that, about our desire for stimulation and our kind of, thinking, well, I don't know if I really want this tranquility. It's not very exciting. So that made me remember the summer I turned 17, and my recently divorced mother decided to take me and my two younger sisters on a vacation to a small out-of-the-way lake in the Sierras for the whole summer, which probably sounds nice to you. It sounds nice to me right now, but at the time I couldn't believe that I was going to have to miss out on the final summer of my high school years, which should have been a time for doing exciting things with all my friends. And this is what I was going to miss out. So it was 1963. There were no cell phones, no computers. Instead, I was going to be truly isolated, and I was devastated. We didn't have the term FOMO then, but I was definitely in the grips of fear of missing out as that summer began and we headed for the hills. I was sure that I was going to have the most dissatisfying summer of my life, and with my boring mother and my boring younger sisters. We had a one-room cabin, no TV, no radio, no phone. I do think we had a cassette player. Our social life for this summer was each other. It was very disappointing. It was a summer of unasked for seclusion and simplicity. However, the reason I remember it now and have remembered that summer fondly throughout my life was that it was the first time I became aware that I could find happiness without the things I thought would make me happy. I think it was maybe my first Buddhist insight. What happened that summer was that without any stimulation from our friends and pastimes to fill up our days, my sisters and I were forced into a deeper connection with each other and into a deeper connection with all those empty moments. And as we have looked back on that summer in later years, we've agreed it was the best. We tell stories about about it now and laugh about all the things we learned about each other. And it turns out we knew how to create our own entertainment after all. That same summer, I had another experience. Toward the end of the summer, we took an excursion to an event, an even remoter location, to visit a relative who lived on a cattle ranch in the Black Rock Desert of Nevada. And I remember that it was 80 miles on a dirt road north of a tiny town with a population of 8 or 80. It was my 17th birthday, and this was how I would spend it. What a celebration. As we drove into nowhere, I saw no trees, just barren hills. It gave me a feeling of desolation and emptiness. I liked the comfort at that time and safety I felt in civilization. But the next day, we took a jeep ride into the hills to a sheep camp, which had a little meadow with a stream running through it. And I remember after lunch, going off to sit by the stream by myself. I remember it was a sunny day. I could hear birds. The colors were bright. There were some wildflowers and willows by the stream. As I was sitting there by myself, I remember being surprised by a feeling of calm and contentment. The setting had none of the trappings of what usually made me happy. There was nothing there but the stream, the willows, the wildflowers, the birds. But I thought to myself with surprise, nothing is missing. And I felt gratitude that I could feel like that. This was also an insight for me because I was aware for the first time of what it meant to turn inward to find happiness and not look out there for it. I'm sure I'd turned inward before to find happiness, but I hadn't been aware that I was doing it. And the awareness was important because it was freeing. I felt freedom. I think some might say that the experience was an experience of turning outward because it seems that I was connecting with nature. But I think we are nature. So when we connect with nature, I feel I'm connecting with a truer form of myself that's greater and truer than my personality. I've been thinking about this memory, and I think it was my first retreat. So, in conclusion, I do think there is a tendency for me, and I think others, to, really like stimulation and distraction. It's hard to put some of those things down. When you have like an online retreat in your own home, it's really, I really feel the lack of stimulation. Like, can I read my book? Because I usually read my book when I go to bed, and things like that. So being with that lack of stimulation is a challenge. And so when we do cultivate tranquility, we do, the mind, wants to go in another direction. And I think that's part of the process of cultivating tranquility and understanding it. And at the same time, that absence of stimulation really helps us see more clearly what really is of value. And sometimes I guess it's kind of like what is that word where you have to let go of things? Begins with an R. When you don't want to give up things, I wrote it down in my notes, but
Renunciation.
yes, that's it. Thank you, Suze. Renunciation. Tranquility requires a bit of renunciation. Yeah. So, my thought for discussion is thinking about tranquility. Let's see. I had three things. When or how do you find tranquility in your meditation or in your everyday life? And are there things you notice that you have to give up reluctantly, that you have to renounce in order to find calm and tranquility? What are those things for you? And are there things that you happily let go of in order to find calm and tranquility? So those were kind of my ideas that we might discuss. And I think we'll
Can
just stay in the
you say
group.
those one more time, please?
Yes. I'll t say them one more time and more slowly. Let's see, where is that? There it is, just a second. Okay, so the first one is, how do you find tranquility? How do you find tranquility? And that could be in meditation or in your daily life. How do you find tranquility in your meditation or in your daily life? And then it's kind of looking at it both ways. Are there things you notice that you have to give up, you know, renounce in order to find calm and tranquility? And are there things that you happily let go of to find calm and tranquility? And if you have something, some other reflection about tranquility, that's fine too. It's just a few things that I thought of. So is tranquility worth the effort? Suze, thanks for starting us off.
Well, I just loved your talk. And what came up for me is how in ordinary life, and even in an ordinary sit, if I give up the busyness that I'm so attached to, the busy mind, the busy schedule, the busy, 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 tranquility's right there. It's like I don't have to really create it or do a lot of work. It's like if I just, your word of simplicity really struck me. And also ordinariness. It's like I can find it pretty easily when I step out of my attachment to busy, busy, do, do, do. So I guess that's answering part of your question of what I have to give up in order to find it. Because I think it's already there. I just kind of covered up with all this other busy. So that was my two bits worth.
Thanks very much. You're starting us off. Sis. What do the rest of you think about tranquility? Is it worth it? Nikhil?
Yeah, I really appreciated that quote you shared about how we like the idea of tranquility, but not oftentimes the reality of it. And I think especially during that transition when I'm noticing anxiety or rushing or kind of what to me feels like kind of the opposite of tranquility, in the moment when I kind of notice that and I'm trying to work towards tranquility, there oftentimes feels like there's this almost this emptiness or this sense of the thing I'm looking for. Well, I'm giving up that thing that I was looking for, that stimulation or whatever I thought was going to be there. And through the practice, I know that, you know, the emptiness is really in the direction of that stimulation. And once I'm able to settle down into the moment, there is something more fulfilled. That thing I was looking for is actually there in the tranquility. But even it's funny how even with the how much practice that I have, I feel like that transition just still feels so difficult sometimes. I think something I've been working with recently is trying to intentionally move my body more slowly whenever I notice rushing. And I was trying to bring awareness to what was the reality of this experience like. And a couple of the interesting things I noticed were that there was a really, really, or not was, but there is, when I'm practicing with this, there's a really strong aversion to moving more slowly or moving my body in a way that is just not the rate at which it's used to doing things. And I noticed it in the most movements that I wouldn't normally bring any awareness to, like even opening a tap or, you know, going to scratch an itch or going to pick something up or all these kind of these movements in between moments of things that I'm doing. as I notice those movements and I try to slow them down, there's this huge aversion to actually doing that. But the other thing I also noticed was when I looked at how long did it take me to do something, whether I was moving my body slowly or whether I was hurrying and rushing, the time was the same. And so that was that kind of a truth that was really helpful for me to notice and be aware of, because whenever my mind is in this rushing mode or this anxious mode, and I'm wanting to move quickly, and I think, well, let me try slowing down, and I feel that aversion, it's helpful to know, well, it doesn't matter if I do this slowly or not, it's going to get done at the same rate. It almost feels like driving a car, and I already know that speeding isn't going to get me there faster. If I want to get there at a certain time, I need to leave on time. It feels like almost the same thing, where I'm starting to think of it almost as like, what speed am I just like driving my life at almost? And it doesn't really matter if I go, you know, speeding's not going to get you there, right? And it's the same thing, it feels like, with like rushing or hurrying. So that's been something that's felt related to tranquility for me.
Thank you for sharing that. That's a lot of observation and insight. Thank you for sharing that. See, if you pay attention to your body, it's just like, it seems like it's nothing, it's just ordinary. But when you really look, you see clearly. It's great. Thank you. Judith, go ahead.
Thank you, Lauren. Something you talking about your trip with your parents reminded me of something that happened when I was a teenager, and I was also forced to go on a trip with my family. And I remember leaving, we were living in Amarillo, Texas, and we'd been there for a few years, which was kind of culture shock because we'd been in Minnesota and, you know, the prairie, the plains, and I didn't like it at all. And I didn't want to go either because I was being taken away from my boyfriend. And I remember sitting in the back seat with my sister, being very sullen and just resentful on the way out, driving through Texas. And then I have this other memory of coming back. I'm in the same car with the same people, the same landscape, and I'm looking out the window and I suddenly see the beauty of the big open sky and the plains and of Texas, which is the first time I had noticed that. And now I'm wondering what happened in between those two experiences. And it was obviously, you know, same circumstances, but it was something in me that changed. And it's like Suze says, the tranquility is in us if the hindrances to experience it aren't there. And so I'm really curious now to wonder what happened in the space of a few weeks. And I don't remember, but it was very interesting.
Yeah.
Think of these two,
yeah,
in juxtaposition. Yeah,
thank you, Judith. Thank you very much. Candace, go ahead.
Yeah, I really liked what Judith just, what everybody's been sharing. I'm just back from retreat, and I had a really interesting experience with, I had decided to go with Philip Moffitt's Renouncing, Comparing, Judging, and Fixing Mind. And always when I've done that, I've been convinced that I do a lot of comparing and judging, but I'm not a fixer. And the first day of just focusing on this on retreat, I realized, boy, am I wrong about being a fixer. That I would just things came up that I realized I've been working so hard trying to change and do make things for other people the way I think they should be. And so it was really interesting to then explore how to let go of that. And what I discovered was when I just sit back and listen and observe and just experience what's going on, I hear so much more, I understand so much more, and I am so much more relaxed. I'm so much calmer. It's like letting go of some job that I imposed on myself that wasn't my job to begin with. And it's amazing how that just relaxed me, and I could feel the tranquility, and I thought, this is just delicious. To just let go of trying to be the manager of the world. I love it.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Sherry, go ahead.
Thanks, Lauren, so much, and everybody. I loved the compost image. And I notice that every once in a while, my just noticing that I'm having a distracted thought or planning thought, it'll just pop and I'll be back where I am. But that's really less frequent than when whatever that thought is pretty sticky and I get interested in it. And I've really noticed that if I do any kind of like barrier, pushing away, cutting off, saying no, that it almost creates like a, it's like the elephant in the room problem. Like it just makes it all that more stickier. And so if I find myself in that place, which is often, I try to say, okay, well, it's here, throw it in. This is also here now. And so, and I've had a lot of different, I had my, a new image about that myself today spontaneously, that it was, oh, these hindrances are enriching my broth. My moment. This is the soup that I'm brewing for my mindfulness right now. And I've also felt like, oh, I just have a room full of all the people in my life sitting with me right now. And if I put them there and I can kind of be with it without, you know, having that struggle with it. So that's my story.
Thank you, Sherry. That does remind me of something Gil Fronstall said, who does, he's on, you're in our Anapanasati class. So he's from Redwood City. He's a teacher from Redwood City, and has lots of talks on Anapanasati and guided meditations. And he talks about accompanying the mind and how if you don't get into the specifics of what's going in the mind, the specifics of the thought, you try to make it something more global, more general. So it reminded me that when you, the way she were talking about the hindrance of like all the people in your life, you put them into a room full. Okay, they're people. You kind of generalize it a little bit, like the soup. You know, it's making me think that that's what you did. You didn't get into the specifics because the specifics and the story are sticky. But if you just get a sense, a global sense of it, it's easier. There's a little more space so you can be with it but not tangled with it. He suggests that, and I thought that you were giving an example of that. Lyndall, go ahead.
Thanks for that great talk, Lauren. I really enjoyed it and got a lot out of it. And one of the things that really struck me was when you were talking about how much we like stimulation, it made me think about why it's so tough, at least for me, to make that transition from rapture to tranquility. Because that rapture state, I mean, I know I find it really easy to just get caught up in all that energy and stuff going on and wanting more of it. And it's hard to actually even want to calm down into tranquility. So it really takes some noticing that all of that stimulation and all of that wanting more and all of that being all stirred up is actually, after a while, it isn't that pleasant. And I'm thinking about that in daily life too, you know, when I'm really looking out there for something to catch my mind, you know, like an exciting TV show or going someplace or reading some book that has all this, you know, suspense or murder or whatever, you know. It's fun, and yet that feeling of wanting to fill up the space with that stuff is really not so pleasant. So that's a really kind of an interesting area to investigate, I find, for myself.
Thank you, Lyndall. Yeah, it really stopped me when I read it. I thought, something true about this. Liz, go ahead.
Hey, that was a fabulous talk. Thank you so much. This is kind of I'm kind of piggybacking on a little bit what Mikkel said and what Candace was tapping into. The interest in how tranquility, like, yeah, if you're going so fast, it's not like it's happening any quicker. And with Candace, that, like, that fixing mind, it definitely does not bring tranquility for me. And I noticed that in my brain, my busyness is a lot around fixing mind, I realized, especially sitting on retreat this weekend. And I feel like the additional added on part of that is, no matter, I think a lot of sometimes my fixing mind is a lot of trying to, like, prevent stuff I don't want from happening, you know, whether it's, you know, I don't want somebody I love to have some suffering, or I need to go pick that weed because my garden's getting a mess. You know, here I am trying to prevent the impossible that could happen. I have no control over the, like, if a bunch of weeds want to show up, or if, you know, somebody I love is ill. So, like, I might as well just stick with tranquility, as hard as that is. That can be hard for me. I have a lot of passion as well. So the idea that it's not getting done any faster, and honestly, I have I have some control over the outcome, but for everybody else and all the rest of life, their path is partially already the path that belongs to them. And that's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Liz. Well, anybody else? We've had a lot of people. Oh, Sarah. Yes, go ahead.
Thank you so much for that great talk. I realized that, I think about, like, the word tranquil, I don't think about that much. And so it's been really interesting the last month to think about it and think about, like, what my perception of tranquility is. And I really appreciated so much of what you said today, because there's so many different ways to kind of arrive at it. And I think in my mind that I think of tranquility as having to have sometimes so many conditions in place. But today in your talk, I wish I could remember kind of how you said it. I'm getting the sense that it can also be something that is kind of more common or simple, such as settling into and being okay with the way things are. I don't know if that's what you said, but there was a point where I felt that. And also just even cultivating simply, say, the awareness of your abdomen as a way of, in the midst of other things, just beginning to cultivate. And so it doesn't have, in my mind, it doesn't have to be a perfect scenario for me to go, oh, this is tranquility. And then that's often followed by craving. So you said a lot of other things today too that were so hit home. So
thank you. Thank you, Sarah. Yeah. Okay. So now it is time to end. So I appreciate everybody sharing. It's really nice to hear the way different people, you know, it's wonderful. We are all individuals and have different experiences, and it's really nice to hear how people are taking different things. So thank you. I want to close with a dedication of merit. So if you just take a time to still your mind and be present for this. We're practicing for the benefit of ourselves, and we turn inward, but we also turn outward. And so may the benefit of everything that we have heard and learned and practiced today benefit ourselves, and may that benefit extend out to people in our neighborhood, our cities, extending out to people we don't know, people who haven't been born yet, all beings, not just human beings. Just imagine that the well-being that we have experienced and the sincerity of our practice has benefits far beyond just us. It goes out into the world. We all beings benefit from our practice. Thank you, everyone, for being here. And if anyone would like to stay, don't leave. And those of you who leave, go ahead.